This week on The Score, what's behind the curtain of selecting jurors? How important was cork during World War II? Is the soybean a miracle plant? Does Europe have a future? All this and more on The Score. Don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. On this week's episode, we'll visit the Virginia Festival of the Book in Charlottesville and talk to some of the authors on the program. But first, we pick up where we left off last week in our conversation with Lizelle Duggar, clerk of the Circuit Court in the city of Charlottesville. I wanted to find out what it was like to work in a courthouse during a trial that brought international attention to a relatively small college town. Duggar was clerk during two such trials, first with George Hughley, a lacrosse player accused of killing his ex-girlfriend, and James Alex Fields, who drove his Dodge Charger into a crowd of people on August 12, 2017, killing Heather Heyer. Here's part two of my interview with Lizelle Duggar. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about was the fact that you've been the Charlottesville Circuit Court clerk for almost 8 years now. And during that time, Charlottesville has been the focus of some criminal cases that attracted international attention. And what is it like to be the clerk at a time when there are satellite trucks outside from CNN and Fox News and the BBC and Japan Broadcasting? This is not typical for any courthouse in America.
It's not. It's the exception to the rule. But having said that, many of my colleagues, particularly in Northern Virginia and in the Tidewater area, have had high-profile cases as well. The D.C. sniper was tried in the Tidewater area. So I'm not alone in that. When the Fields case came to trial late last year...
And he was the guy who drove the car into the protesters on August 12th.
Correct. And he was charged with originally the second-degree murder of Heather Heyer. It was upgraded to first-degree murder, and that's what the jury convicted him on. So when that started, when the process to prepare for that started, there was a good argument that I actually was the clerk that was good to be here. Because when I got elected in 2011 and took office in January 2012, the George Hughley case went to trial in February 2012. We had 175 media credentialed folks parked outside our
house. Now, are you the person who issues those credentials?
No. So the beauty of the city of Charlottesville is we cooperate with the city government. So the communications office for the city of Charlottesville handled all that. And Mr. Garrett was in my predecessor. He was in the planning process in 2011 before I ever became clerk. So he worked with the communications director at the time, and that was Rick Barrick. And he worked with Judge Hogshire and the sheriff so that they came up with a media plan. But the credentialing happened in the communications office in City Hall. And that's exactly what we did when we got to Fields. The credentialing and everything regarding media attendance was handled through the communications department. At that point, it was Brian Wheeler, who's our communications director. And he and I worked closely with regards to where in the courtroom are we going to reserve seats for the media? How are they going to access records? We have two photocopy machines in my office. There's no way it could accommodate media requests for copies. So the city set up on its website under Circuit Court a link where I could upload everything that was filed in court so that folks could look at it, print it if they wanted, and they wouldn't need to come to my office and bombard my staff as well as overwork our poor copy machine. So, you know, I mistakenly said after we finished the Hughley trial that I'm glad that's over with. Once in a career is great. Well, now I know better. I didn't say that after Fields. You know, and I had great people work with so that it happened as smoothly as it did. And one of the kudos is, you know, we were supposed to move into this temporary swing space and the court renovations were supposed to start in October of 2018. The Fields trial was set to begin November, the Monday after Thanksgiving in 2018. And we sat down, the judge and I and the sheriff sat down with facilities and says, we can't do that. We are going to have a full courtroom with folks wanting access, and we just can't do it in a small courtroom. So we delayed our move here so that we could do Fields in our main courtroom over at 315 East High. But again, it was just a cooperative effort all around to get it to happen as smoothly as it did.
And while that was going on, while the trial was happening and all the media people from around the world were here, was there any disruption to your normal business with, you know, real estate folks or people coming in looking for records? Were they able to do that and not feel intimidated?
Yes. So I will say we were pleasantly surprised. We did not have as many media present for the Fields trial as we did for the Hughley trial.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it was less. And any folks that didn't get to do business with our office, it was self-selection. We, you know, we told them this is what's happening. We're open. But they could decide to come back after December 14th, which is when the trial was set to finish. So our office remained open. People were able to come in. They would have to run the gamut of the barricades that both the sheriff and the police, Charlottesville police, put up so that we could control if something were to happen. But if you could get through that and security, you were still able to do business in our office. Now, one of the things we did do differently from when we tried Hughley and when we tried Fields, the judge entered an order in Fields that the entire courthouse, you could not bring in bags, backpacks, anything like, and that included my office. So that was a difference from, you know, in Hughley, you weren't allowed to carry it into the courtroom, but you could bring it down to my clerk's office. For Fields, the judge felt just overall it was best to just do the blanket prohibition. So if you're an attorney doing a recordation, you came in with a file and the check. You didn't come in with your briefcase. You didn't, you know, if you were a runner, you didn't have your backpack with you, you know, that kind of stuff. And cell phones were prohibited then, so you left your cell phone at the office. So that was an inconvenience for our customers. And thankfully, it lasted for, what was it, beginning after Thanksgiving, all the way we finished up on December 12th or 13th.
So that's only about 2 weeks. Yeah. It could have been a lot worse.
It could have been a lot worse. And I will do a shout out. The jury, the jurors, not just the people who actually sat in our jury, but the 356 people that I summoned for jury duty that then eventually was whittled down to a little over 170. They were completely understanding with the wait times. We were doing individual voir dire. You know, we did the general voir dire, and then each prospective juror was taken back in the judge's conference room for individual voir dire because there were a lot of questions both sides had to ask to make sure they had a fair jury. And not that my faith in human nature is low, but these prospective jurors literally raised my faith in humanity. They were all very respectful. It didn't matter what their political leanings, their personal beliefs, their moral beliefs. They answered questions truthfully, honestly, and respectfully. And we were in closed quarters during individual voir dire. Mr. Fields was in there with us with his attorneys. And it was just kudos to the citizens of Charlottesville that I summoned for jury duty. They were amazing.
How many jury summonses do you issue in a typical year?
In a typical year, I asked my jury commissioners to provide me probably about 2,000 names out of all the questionnaires we got. So we have six terms of court, and I typically do 200 to 225 jurors in a regular term of court. When I have a felony criminal trial going up, I summon 40 in so that we can get 12.
Mm-hmm.
When I have a civil trial or a misdemeanor trial, I will summon 30 so that we can get 7. If it's a multi-day trial or if it's a trial that has a trial that involves the University of Virginia Hospital, we will tend to summon more because a lot of our jurors work for the University Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, depending on where they work, I mean, it doesn't disqualify them, but if they work in the department that's being sued, yeah,
mm-hmm.
they probably should not sit on that jury. So the most I summons for a typical felony jury is 40.
And where do you draw the names from?
So every August or September, I get a list from the state that has voter registration and DMV registration for folks in the city of Charlottesville. When I started, that's all we relied on. And
mm-hmm.
we would get we would send out the questionnaires, the initial questionnaires, and we would get 50% coming back as bad addresses.
Really?
That's a lot of postage
yeah.
and taxpayer money that gets wasted. And so both Judge Hogshire, when he was the judge when I came in, and then Judge Moore after Judge Hogshire retired, both said, are there other databases we can look at? So we, you know, David and I looked at the statute, and it said that the judge could, as long as it was a randomly selected database where there was no exclusion of people for whatever, the judge could order the clerk to pull from that. So with that in hand, we started pulling from our utility database in the city. We started pulling from our personal property. We didn't do real estate taxes
mm-hmm.
because we didn't want just homeowners. We did property taxes, personal property taxes, cars, boats, thing. And those are the two, utilities and personal property taxes that we put together with voter registration and DMV registration to come up with about 5,000 names a year that we send out the questionnaire to. Our return, we would get about 10% back, which was a little bit more acceptable to me
yeah.
than 50%. And then from there, before December, late November, early December, the judge pulls together three people for my jury commissioners. And we give them all that.
And who are the jury commissioners?
They are members of the community. They are basically, the judge can ask me, can ask the sheriff, can ask a prior judge, who do you think would be a good jury commissioner? And it's I take my list from the judge. They issue the summons for the jury commissioners, and we have three different ones every year.
And they serve for a term of 1 year?
1 year.
Mm-hmm. And I've never heard of the jury commissioners before.
Well, and typically they serve for 1 day because
uh-huh.
they'll have, you know, whatever questionnaires David and I get back in this office, and their task is to find qualified jurors. And I give them a number. My target number last year when we had Fields was I need 3,000
mm-hmm.
because I knew I was going to be summoning more people for that particular trial. And so they go through, the three of them, individual for each one, and they look at if someone has moved, if someone is deceased, if someone is claiming I'm 70 years old and I'd like to claim my exemption. You are not immediately exempted. It's you need to ask to be exempted if you're over 70. We have jurors who are in their 70s and 80s who serve, and
mm-hmm.
we love having them come. And if they're a practicing attorney, if they're a sitting judge, those are all exemptions that the jury commissioners pick up. And so they have the disqualified stack and then hopefully the larger qualified stack. And then they give that to us, and we scan it into a jury management system that the city IT people wrote that program for us. And that's my pool
mm-hmm.
for any given year. And each term of court, we will pull, if we have, it just depends how many juries are set for that term, we'll pull anywhere from 175 to 225 taking out the fields kind of trial. And those are the folks that get summoned for jury orientation. And that's all random. It's all done by the computer. At this point, we don't have, with the numbers, we don't look at who these folks are. My friends claim that since I became clerk, they've been called to jury duty. And I said, I have nothing to do. I push the button. When we get to each term, I say, I need 200 jurors for this term. We'll put in 200, and the judge has to be here because he has to be here to select the pool. And monkey flips the switch. We push it, and we get 200 names randomly from the 2,000 that the jury commissioners gave us. Those are the people who get the nice letter from the judge saying you are now summoned to jury duty. Actually, I guess the letter's over my name. And then they come to jury orientation. And then, again, we get a case, criminal case. I go on to our jury management system. I need 40 random names. I put 40 in, hit the button. I get 40 from that 200. So everything is randomly selected. I don't see it until we have a jury list, which we have no juries that went forward yet, so I don't even have a jury list for this term. But that's the first time I get a look at who actually got summoned.
And Charlottesville is a medium to small size city, so I can imagine that this process, if it's taking place in Fairfax or Prince William or Virginia Beach, it requires a lot more names and a lot more activity.
And they're computerized. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have, and we eventually would like to get there, where you can fill out your jury. You'll get a summons, and you can just log in and fill in your jury questionnaire online, which then comes to us. And then we would provide laptops to our jury commissioners, and they can review it in digital format as well. We would like, I mean, there's a lot of paper that we end up with the jury management system. So another place where we can save some cost is just paper. And see if we can get it into a digital form. But yes, in Fairfax, it's all done. My understanding in Loudoun, everything is done on computer. We'll get there eventually. and it's larger numbers. Then of course you hear about in California where they have a case that will last 6 months.
Yeah, and that can be a real burden to a juror because you can't go to work. And I don't know what they pay in California, but
we pay $30 a day here.
Yeah, that's what I recall. The one time I was called for a jury service
it's
here,
$30. It's not. It's a reimbursement cost for mileage and meal. That's all it is. It's not even payment for jury duty. It's a reimbursement cost.
Yeah, and that's not enough to pay the rent.
No,
if you're sequestered for 6 months.
Well, and that's the thing. We have never, neither of the judges I've worked with have ever sequestered a jury. I mean, the Hughley jury was not, they were allowed to go home. They were admonished not to watch the news, not to talk to anybody about the case, but they were never sequestered. But having said that, 2.5 weeks in Hughley and almost 2 weeks in Fields, you're asking, and I can't remember how many we had in Hughley, but in Fields, I had 16 jurors because we had 12 plus four alternates sit through over a week. And then we had a snow day in there too. So that's a lot to ask of folks.
Yeah.
You know, to give, but yet not one complaint with my 16 jurors who got selected and realize they were stuck with me for 2 weeks, the possibility of 2 weeks, not one complaint.
Yeah, we could go on talking about this for another hour. maybe I'm just geeky, but this is really fascinating stuff.
I love this job. I mean, you know, 8 years is a long time, but I'm not bored yet, and I don't know that I ever will be. And so asking, you know, running for reelection for me was a no-brainer. One, I hadn't fulfilled my promise. You know, I'm about maybe halfway there if I'm being generous. But I want to finish what I started. But the flip side is I have fun. I have fun with my staff. I have fun with the customers. It's just really something I enjoy. And I didn't know if I would 8 years ago. I mean, I knew I could do it. I knew I'd had the skill sets to do it. But I couldn't tell you that I would enjoy it as much as I did being a public defender for 12 years. But I do, in a very different way. I get asked all the time, do you miss being a public defender? No. I miss aspects of being a practicing attorney, but I don't miss it because I'm really enjoying what I'm doing now.
Well, that's a great recommendation. And you're running for re-election, but I don't think you anticipate having an opponent in November, do you?
Well, so first I got to get through the primary. Mm-hmm. So I will know by 5 p.m. March 28th if anybody is going to challenge me for the Democratic nomination mm-hmm. on June 11th. Then June 11th at 7 p.m. when the polls close, I will know if someone is going to challenge me either as a Republican or as an independent mm-hmm. In the general election. Right now, there's no one that's announced Democrat, Republican, or independent. I'm crossing my fingers that continues. But, you know, it's a process. And if someone wants to run for clerk, I think they should.
I might be mistaken, but if I recall correctly, the last time a Republican ran for clerk of the court was 1969.
You're mistaken.
Oh, I am.
Yes.
Okay.
Richard DeLoria ran against Mr. Garrett. I can't remember which year, mm-hmm. but Richie did run as a Republican. So I was elected in 2011. 2003, Vanessa Hicks challenged Mr. Garrett at the caucus, Democratic mm-hmm. caucus. So 1998 was when Richie DeLoria ran as a Republican.
1998?
No,
93. No, 95, no. I think it would be.
So 2003
minus 8 would be...
This is why I'm a lawyer.
And not a mathematician. So it would be, I guess, 1995, I think it would
maybe.
Be.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah, the last three times that Mr. Garrett ran for re-election, he had a challenge either at the at the caucus level, mm-hmm. well, at the primary level with me, at the caucus level, the eight years before me, and then at the general election. The 8 years before that.
Okay, that was before I moved to Charlottesville. Uh-huh. So that's probably why I don't
but
remember.
I only know that because Richie and I were sharing office spaces as lawyers with Dave Heilberg, and he was running for clerk. That's really the only reason I know that. But yeah, that was the last time.
Okay, so it's been more than 20 years.
Yes.
And okay. Well, Lizelle, thank you for your time today. I've learned a lot, and I will probably have to divide this into two segments, one for this week and one for next week.
But, well, I always enjoy talking to you, Rick, so thank you for taking the time out to do this.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
This year, the Virginia Festival of the Book is celebrating its 25th anniversary. Over the years, it has brought hundreds of authors and thousands of book lovers to Charlottesville. Author James Kirchick was a guest on The Score last April when he talked to us about his book, The End of Europe. Jamie is back this week because he spoke in Charlottesville at the book festival. I asked him about some events and trends that emerged in the year since we last spoke.
Jamie Kirchick, it's been about a year since we last talked about your book, The End of Europe, and there have been developments in the past 12 months, and one of them is the Gilets Jaunes movement in France, the Yellow Vest. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, this was a movement that began in protest of fuel surcharges, gas taxes that... the president was imposing partly to raise revenue, but also as part of his green agenda, the anti-global warming agenda. And I think it had pretty broad support at first, but in recent months it's really degenerated and been kind of taken over by the extremes, extreme left, extreme right. And you see lots of racist and anti-Semitic rhetoric being voiced by these people. And I think they've really damaged their reputation among the public. But it also has led to diplomatic spat that's been unprecedented between Italy and France, where you saw the Italian deputy prime minister visiting with these Gilets Jaunes leaders in Paris, and that led the French to withdraw their ambassador from Italy, which hasn't happened since World War II.
I had not heard about that, but what is Italy's interest in protesting?
Well, Italy has a populist government. You have the Five Star Movement, which is a populist party that was started by a comedian. They're in coalition with a party called the League, which is a, you'd say, right-wing anti-immigrant party. And they see something to admire in these Gilets Jaunes protesters.
Well, that actually segues into my next question, which may not seem related, but it is. You were talking just about Brexit and Britain wants to leave the EU, but there's a lot that's happened in the last 12 months on that, but also because of
alleged Russian interference in the original Brexit referendum and Russia's interest in diminishing the European Union. Italy seems to be a good target for the next lever. Do you agree?
No, just because even the League party that I just mentioned earlier, they are they come from the north, which is the real sort of industrial heartland. They depend enormously on trade within the EU. Italy, the Italian economy is so integrated and has been for decades, more than the British one.
And of course, Italy was an original member of
Italy
the EU.
Italy is an original, one of the five original members of the EU. I don't see an Italian exit coming.
But do you see Russian interference in Italy?
Yes. I mean, certainly there was, they had a constitutional referendum a couple of years ago. The Russians were involved. But I would actually say, and then the League has a formal agreement with the United Russia Party, and the deputy and the Interior Minister Salvini, who's the leader of the League Party, has spoken very warmly of Vladimir Putin. But you know, Italy, this government has been in power for over a year, and they haven't stopped the sanctions, which they could theoretically do that. They could veto the sanctions or not participate in them, and they haven't done that. So I think that the fears of sort of Russian interference in Italy have not been fully borne out yet.
Getting back to the broader question of Brexit, how do you assess the situation? It looks like it's causing chaos in the British polity.
Yeah.
Where's it going?
Well, we've seen the formation of a new political party, which hasn't happened in a very long time. I think the entire sort of British government has been just sort of redirected towards Brexit. All the ministries, all the civil servants, I think something I read or heard yesterday, something like 70% of the civil servants have had their work has now been redirected towards dealing with Brexit, the fallout from Brexit, how to comply with Brexit. The country's resources and efforts have been just devoted to this one issue. And it's just unfortunate to see the country really convulse like this.
What do you think would happen if there were a second referendum?
I actually don't think the results would be necessarily different from the first. And that's what all the polling shows. So, you know, this clamor for a second referendum, I'm not really sure that it would result in something dramatically different.
I think I heard today that a cabinet minister has criticized Theresa May for her handling of the situation, which is somewhat unprecedented, because you might hear a backbencher say something, but what does that say about it?
It just shows you how divided the Conservative Party is, that it's difficult for her to even have members of her own government who are fully on board. But at the same time, there's no one group within the Conservative Party that has enough to really kind of take over. There's so many different divisions within the parties themselves. You see that in the Labour Party. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn can barely keep a front bench team as well. And he was overwhelmingly in it. They had a vote of no confidence in the Labour Party among his own parliamentarians 3 years ago. And he was overwhelmingly rejected by his own members of his own party. So you have these two leaders who are basically lame ducks in their own way, but because of the system, it's this kind of stasis, and you know, they won't overthrow. In other circumstances, you would have a revolt and they would overthrow her, but they don't want to do that because they don't want to create a situation where there's a new election where Jeremy Corbyn could come into power. Mm-hmm. So all these different factors are creating a situation where there's not going to be any change. It's basically sealed shut.
From what you say, it seems unlikely that if there were an election today or 6 months from now that there could be a majority government from any party.
No, because certainly now where you have this breakaway independent group has really shown the divisions within the Labour Party. So, and then you add in the Scottish Nationalists to the picture, that it's very difficult to see any real sort of government emerging from this that can really speak for a majority of the country.
I mentioned when we just started talking that we did an interview, I think in April of last year. A lot has happened since then in terms of U.S.-European relations. Trump has been a bull in the China shop. How is that emerging?
I tend to think that we focus on Trump too much, certainly in in every aspect, whether domestic politics or foreign policy.
I agree with you in a sense, because I get the daily press releases from the State Department, and they read like anything that would have happened under John Kerry.
Right, and I think, you know, for Europeans, he's become a very sort of easy target to kind of ignore real long-term structural systemic problems. You know, Donald Trump doesn't have really anything to do with the fact that the growth rate in Europe has been so anemic over the past couple of years. Donald Trump doesn't have anything to do with the fact that, you know, the German military can barely field an army, that its submarines aren't working, that it can barely fly any of its planes. That's not Donald Trump's fault. Donald Trump isn't to blame for the fact that, you know, France and Italy have withdrawn their ambassadors from their respective countries. So you can whine about Donald Trump all you want, but he's really not the be-all, end-all of these problems.
Veteran journalist Pam Kelly is author of Money Rock, a family story of cocaine, race, and ambition in the New South. I spoke to Pam Kelly after a panel discussion called Southern Discomfort, Journalists Explore Guns and Drugs.
So give me your elevator pitch. What did you take to a publisher to say, this is a book that you should be selling?
Well, this is a story of a cocaine dealer and his family, but it's set against Charlotte's history of racism and urban poverty. It's in some ways, it's got some true crime elements, broad daylight shootout, a botched FBI sting, a judge nicknamed Maximum Bob, who ultimately sentences my protagonist, who was known on the streets as Money Rock, to 21 years in prison. 24, actually. He served 21. But the larger story is a social history about Charlotte and its racism and how it shaped the destinies of these characters.
And where did you get the idea for writing this story?
Actually, as a young reporter, in 1986, I covered Money Rock's trial, and then I interviewed him. And I went on and I forgot about him, and decades passed. I continued as a reporter, and I read something by Jay-Z in 2011 talking about his beginnings as a crack dealer, and it reminded me of Money Rock, and I wondered what had become of him. And so I looked him up, I found him, called him, he remembered me, and he said, I had been wanting somebody to tell my story. So that's kind of how it began.
And so he told you what had transpired between 1986 and whenever you started writing the book.
Right. And also his childhood, the backstory of, how he got to be Money Rock, which was also really fascinating.
I bet. So what were some of the sociological conditions that you delved into that affected the life of Money Rock mm-hmm. and his family and the community?
Mm-hmm. Well, his mom and his parents grew up in Jim Crow, Charlotte. His mom became an activist, actually. But they lived in public housing that was, it wasn't, by the time he lived there, it wasn't segregated by law, but it was still segregated. There just were a lot, even though he went to integrated schools, there just weren't the opportunities for black people in Charlotte when he was growing up. And he kind of saw that and saw that maybe his best opportunity was to sell cocaine.
And as you were doing research for this book, what kind of policy implications did you find in terms of changing laws or changing practices or regulations?
Mm-hmm. I found so many policy implications, and just to take in one area, I mean, it was really interesting how by telling the story of Belton and three generations of his family, you could talk about all sorts of policies from housing to criminal justice. But on the criminal justice front, I mean, I guess the mass incarceration, the fact that Belton served more than 21 years, that he had three sons die while he was in prison, that his sons got in trouble while he was in prison. I mean, I think that story has so many policy implication when it comes to criminal justice reform.
And did you talk to some people who are in the criminal justice reform arena, and what are they advocating, and what would you agree or disagree mm-hmm. with them on?
I would say locally, within the criminal justice system locally, I think there is a lot of recognition that what they did didn't work. I mean, I've talked to one of the top prosecutors who said, you know, I'm really, when I look back on those days, I'm not proud of this. So I think they are trying to do at a local level what they can. But we have a conservative legislature, I don't think that's interested in criminal justice reform. I think that's the case in a lot of cities that are much more liberal than their state legislatures.
Yeah, and in Charlotte, like Charlottesville, mm-hmm. we are, is far more liberal than the state that we
right.
live in.
Right.
And so you have these, you know, I've gone up to Richmond to testify on, you know, marijuana law reform mm-hmm. and hit a brick wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that's very much the case
yeah.
in Charlotte and in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you think people should take away from this book? What's the message that you think readers will discern from it?
What I hope people take away, for me, so much of this was news. I was not taught all this history. I have learned about urban renewal and redlining and so many policies that we don't, that are just systemic racism. So I kind of feel like the first step in moving forward is recognizing the problem. And in order to understand where we want to go with policy, we have to understand the history behind it.
And the history of redlining is really interesting when you look back and see that it was a New Deal initiative that if the Federal Housing Administration couldn't have existed if they hadn't added redlining to the package.
Well, and it's my understanding, too, it also came about during the Depression because, mm-hmm. like, you know, lending had pretty much stopped, just a lot like it did in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a way to reassure lenders that these areas, I think it was the blue areas or the green areas that are the good areas. These are good. You're going to be safe if you lend money here. But as a result, I mean, it just starved these black neighborhoods of investment for decades and decades.
So how long did you actually work on this book from the time you first put pen to paper to when
yeah.
it got published?
About 6 years. And, you know, that wasn't like full time. I had a job as a newspaper reporter through a lot of that time.
Soybeans are one of the most important cash crops in the world. They provide nutrition for millions of people and produce components for industry as well. Matthew Roth is author of Magic Bean, The Rise of Soy in America, a history of the soybean over the past 100 years or so.
What was the elevator pitch you gave to a publisher? What did you do? What did you say to convince somebody to publish this book?
You know, I hate to say it sold itself, but there was kind of an interest in soybeans, I think for the very reason I was interested in them, because people, they're everywhere, but people don't have a firm idea of how they got everywhere, especially since, you know, people have an idea that at one point they came from Asia, but now they're here. So I think the curiosity I had was reflected in the curiosity of the various publishers that I shopped the book to, and the University of Kansas Press, University Press of Kansas, accepted.
And it's just about 100 years ago that the soybean growers formed their own association.
Yes.
An anniversary is coming up. And the 20th century was a time of great development, but you seem to have identified an inflection point at sort of the end of World War II. Could you expand on that?
There were several inflection points. As I mentioned in the talk, 1928 was an important inflection point in establishing the soy industry in the Midwest. What World War II did was bring a big expansion of the meat industry and production by new, what we'd call factory farming methods of chickens and hogs and then of cattle. And soy, soybean meal used in mixed feeds was a key input to the development of that system. So as that system expanded, the demand for soybean meal expanded, And as that happened, researchers discovered new ways of using the soybean oil to similarly expand its presence. So it was, again, a virtuous cycle of investment that went on there.
It's kind of ironic that you stated earlier that you came to this topic because of your being a vegetarian.
Yes.
And yet soybeans are used as animal feed for, you know, feeding omnivores.
Well, you know, nothing is good or evil, but our uses of it make it so. And in fact, in the 70s, where you had books like The Book of Tofu come out, that were promoting soy foods, so foods made in traditional ways directly from soybeans, that was actually a constant refrain. We're growing all these soybeans, we're funneling them through animals, and thus, you know, creating all of that waste before we get the actual protein. Why not just eat the protein directly? You know, the big fans of soybeans, you know, have been on a mission to sort of reclaim and redeem it from, you know, just what you talk about.
And you mentioned a couple of big fans of soybeans, one being hippies and the other being Henry Ford, who couldn't be more of the opposite of a hippie. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, Henry Ford, I mean, he's, you know, sui generis. He's a unique case, but he had a vision of rural life that in some ways wasn't altogether different from the hippies who settled on the farm in Tennessee. He had a vision of rural life that was upgraded to get away from most of the drudgery of farm tasks and instead perform valuable industrial tasks like extracting soybean oil. And interestingly, when the you know, hippies from San Francisco settled on the farm, they had a similar idea of being voluntary. They called it voluntary peasants, who would embrace technology in order to upgrade peasant life. So they their technology was a lot more makeshift and cobbled together, but also very creative. But still had this idea that if you created soy dairies, you know, you would and actually spread them to third world countries, that kids growing up on soy milk and around soy dairies would be healthier, and that rural life itself would be lifted up. And in fact, you know, this is a whole other story. They had a charitable arm called Plenty, which did set up soy dairies in Guatemala before they had to kind of flee when the Guatemalan civil wars happened. But yeah, in some odd ways, their visions actually did coincide.
Do you have any idea of how many products are derived from soybeans?
Oh, you know, countless, if you look on some of the, you know, websites. But aside from, you know, the various soy foods, you know, some popular ones are, or at least industrial products, are soy ink. And in fact, Ford, kind of reviving its founder's dreams, just a few years ago had advertisements promoting the soy foam that it was using in its automobiles. So it's kind of the wheel turning around again. And then there are things like biodiesel, which began with the use of soybeans. So yeah, it's a wide array.
In the past few months, soybeans have been in political news because of so many farmers in the United States almost going under because of the trade wars. Can you comment on that at all?
You know, it's hard to find an exact historical parallel to that, but there have been previous embargoes on the sale of of soybeans internationally. Probably the best parallel was in 1980, where there was an embargo on selling all sorts of products to the Soviet Union because of the invasion of Afghanistan. Soybeans was one of those products. In 1980, what happened, and I mentioned in the book, was that U.S. suppliers switched to other markets. Emerging suppliers such as Brazil then sold to the Soviet Union. I called it a game of musical chairs where there are plenty of chairs to go around. The difference this time, the reason that that's not, you know, a good parallel to what's happening now, is that unlike the Soviet Union then, China is by far the preeminent market for soybeans, and mainly when they import soybeans, it's for meat production, not for traditional soy foods. They generally use their own soybeans for that. So China's this huge market, the best market in the world. So sort of torturing the musical chairs analogy, China was the best seat in the house. And so now it's not easy to just scramble for new suppliers, which was one of the problems. The other being that China has in part responded by decreasing its demand for soybeans, so not just moving things around. And any slight decrease in Chinese demand for soybeans, because it's so preeminent, causes a collapse of the entire, you know, world market, basically. So that's sort of the difference this time.
Most people think of cork as the thing that keeps wine fresh in its bottle. For the first half of the 20th century, it was an important industrial product that was largely irreplaceable. It was necessary for winning World War II. David Taylor describes cork's importance in his recent book, Cork Wars: Intrigue and Industry in World War II.
Cork is the really the bark, the outer layer of the cork oak tree, the Corcus suber. Mainly grows around the Mediterranean and particularly in Portugal and Spain.
And what was the pitch you gave to your publisher? What did you say to convince them to take this book and distribute it?
A couple of things. One was that cork had an unexpected history in America, and particularly in World War II, and illustrated dynamics that the families involved in its showed a different lens on World War II and American life at that point. And so it was a different connection of nature, industry, and national security.
Most people today would only associate cork with what goes into the top of a wine bottle, but as you were explaining, it had a lot of industrial uses that seem to have been superseded by plastics and other materials. Say, what were the sorts of things that cork was used for at the time of World War II that we wouldn't think about today?
Right. Well, one of them is one that I actually do remember from in the 60s into the 70s, when cork was used, slivers of cork in the top of a soda bottle. And so you would see, it was used in that kind of a sealing capacity in many things. So in cars, it was used to seal windshields, and as well as for the kind of the veneer effect on dashboards. And it was used in flooring and walls. It's insulation and soundproofing were some of the qualities that made it really useful, but it was in this really ability to seal in a way that until we had plastic was not really possible. So it was kind of essential.
I get the sense that your book is a lot about intrigue during World War II, spying, sabotage, the industrial processes of the war. And some of your sources must have been very elderly when you interviewed them. How did you find them?
It's interesting. Well, some of the records of the OSS, the wartime spy agency, were declassified in only about 11, 12 years ago. And so going to the National Archives, I was able to find memos, OSS memos, of records, contacts with industry, and particularly these cork industrial contacts, both the Armstrong cork and Crown cork and seal, and the names of people involved. And so from there, and that declassified information, I was able to find several of the families and talk with them about what they remember of their father's involvement. In fact, in one case, I did have an email exchange with a former OSS operative in Spain. So you're right. We are at the tail end of firsthand memory of that period. And so I felt it was important to capture what I could there. So it was a combination of those firsthand interviews and the documentary evidence that either had just been declassified or that I was able to get through Freedom of Information Act requests.
And how did you come across this story? It seems obscure, and yet it was such an important component of the war effort.
Yes, in a way, I came across it by accident. It came to me. I had written about forests in conflict before. And so when I found an article while I was working on another book about the WPA writers in the 1930s, I found an article in the early 40s about this this campaign to grow trees in a patriotic way, this cork trees, and that it was fulfilling a national security gap to have cork oak. And I thought, this is kind of a unusual purpose for a tree growing campaign. What was involved in that? And so that led me to actually to speak to the first interview that who recalled that and recalled the fire, and that sort of started my interest in the story. Part of it, I think, why it had been forgotten was, in some sense, the shift in American material culture that we don't think of cork that way. And part of it was the national security secrecy around issue. You couldn't publish things about, during the war, about materials that were deemed critical. And so, and then afterwards, the people who had worked in the espionage portion couldn't talk about it really until these materials were declassified. And by that point, it wasn't something that people would be looking for. But I guess my experience with the National Archives was, now that those records are open, that they are a lot more connections of corporate involvement in espionage that can be found there.
That sounds like a really interesting aspect of things. There seems to be a parallel between cork and related products during World War II and what we talk about as strategic minerals today, you know, like lithium and rare earths and such, and cobalt in Congo, where there's very limited access. It's only found in one place, essentially. Do you draw any parallels there?
Absolutely, yeah. In the book, I talk about actually the parallel with rare earths today. In fact, where this material that is kind of crucial to electronics, whether it's your very small amounts of it in your cell phones and speakers, all of that comes from southern China and the soils of southern China. And it is the Pentagon issued a report last fall saying this is a national security vulnerability that we have. And now with the trade tensions with China, it continues to be a situation that's very much parallel with something that is an important part of everyday life that we don't necessarily see every day, suddenly takes on a different importance and gets more attention. So there is a lot of research now in finding how we find rare earth substitutes or replacements from domestic materials. Do we extract it from coal? Do we find other countries that have some deposits of it? So it's
I understand that there are a lot of rare earths and slag heaps in the American West when they were mining other minerals, and that was just waste, and now you can go back and pick that up. My last question relates to the 4-H Arbor Day campaign and planting the cork trees across the United States. None of those trees would have been mature enough to get the cork by the end of the war. Is that true?
Not by the end, yeah. It would only have been if the war lasted another 10 to 15 years. And, of course, nobody knows how long war is going to last. I mean, we've had a war last, 18, 19 years now. But it was, you're right, that it was the kind of a long shot payoff that this company owner, Charles McManus Sr., liked to try. He thought this would engage people's, make people feel like they're contributing to a patriotic effort. And maybe in the long run it could create some pipeline for his business, for the cork business in the future.
Were any of those trees ever harvested?
Some were harvested during the war. I mean, actually, some of the ones, there were several older trees in California that actually provided some of the seed stock for the thing, and they did harvest cork from trees in California to test out the technology and whether people could do it. But after the war, to my knowledge, no. I've talked to people who had planted the trees and had gone back to check and see that they were still healthy, but I don't know that anybody has harvested them.
Is there a future for industrial cork in the 21st century?
Worldwide, yes. I would say there's actually a renewed future for it in a sustainable production of materials in a way that's both it avoids the problems of plastic waste that doesn't decompose, that is, we're now seeing in oceans, and in health risks of plastic residues that stay with it, with the, you know, in the environment. Cork can be and is seeing a renewed prospect for both, you know, continuing use for things that it's always been used for, like for flooring, but also materials, whether it's containers, bags, things like that, that you can actually make in sort of a paper form or in something that feels like a leather wallet. It is a very flexible material.
That's all the time we have for this week's episode of The Score. We'll be back next week with more news, reviews, and interviews, including more conversations from the Virginia Festival of the Book. For all the editors and writers at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to come back to listen next week and tell your friends where to find us. Join in on the conversation at BeringDrift.com. We'll be waiting for you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at RickSincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BeringDrift.com.